I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is RAG Radio.
We're glad to have you with us.
RAG Radio is where we are driving in the left lane. Is that right, Tracy? We come your way every Friday afternoon from 2 to 3 p.m. live on Co-op 91.7 FM in Austin, which is an all-volunteer, cooperatively run, solar-powered community radio station. So we got it all going for us, right?
Yeah, doing all right.
And Tracy, and we're syndicated. We're rebroadcast on a number of other stations, and our podcasts are out there. We're produced in conjunction with the RAG blog and the New Journalism Project. And I wore my bright pink, kind of, is this pink? I guess it's sort of pink.
Yeah.
Hawaiian shirt.
Salmon?
In honor of the fact that we actually have sun today and a blue sky. We haven't had that for about a week. So in Austin, Texas, there's some sun, but it rained for a week. Before that, it didn't rain for, what, a month? 2 months?
Yeah, yeah.
And before that, it just it was. But we can't complain about
rain
situations, right? So Tracy Schultz is my engineer and my my co-conspirator. How are you, Tracy?
Doing well. Doing well. Happy to be here.
You hanging in there?
Yeah.
Roger Baker is here taking pictures. And our guest is Julius Jack Gettman, and we're thrilled to have you with us today. This is going to be fun. Jack is the author of The Supreme Court on Unions, Why Labor Law is Failing American Workers. He's a labor law scholar and an emeritus professor of law at the University of Texas at Austin. He is also the author of The Betrayal of Local 14, Paper Workers, Politics, and Permanent Replacements. And both of those were published by Cornell University Press.
Right.
And it's a fascinating trajectory. It's a the subject matter that you're dealing with, and of course you're a scholar in the area, but the whole question of labor unions and how they have evolved and the role that the courts have played, the strength, they were very, very strong for a while and made an important difference for American workers. Why don't you give us a little sort of overview of what you're saying in this book?
Well, what I'm pointing out is since 1947, the last time Congress acted, the Supreme Court has been the major decider on issues concerning the rights of workers and the rights of unions. And I think that if you look at every area of union activity, the court has ended up taking unnecessary anti-union positions. It began with the decimation of the right to strike, which is what I dealt with in my book, The Betrayal of Local 14, that having to do with the ability of employers to permanently replace striking workers. The National Labor Relations Act states, and almost every country in the world holds, that workers have a right to strike. And it says it in bold letters in the National Labor Relations Act. And then it says, nothing herein shall diminish in any way the right to strike. Turns out, due to a long ago decision of the Supreme Court, that if you strike, you are subject to being permanently replaced. That means you lose your job. Many years ago, when I taught at Indiana University, I used to work with steelworkers. They couldn't believe it. They would say, wait, don't we have a right to strike? And I'd say, yes, it's right there in the statute. Well, how come we can lose our jobs? And I sort of had to answer, because the law is stupid. The Supreme Court has constantly reaffirmed that doctrine. It's known as the McKay Doctrine. And it's served in many, many instances, employers forced unions to strike one way or another, then permanently replace the workers, and then hold a vote by the scabs and replacement workers, and the union is voted out. So the strike has became, over the years, with the support of the Supreme Court, an employer weapon rather than a union weapon, except under very limited circumstance where the union has really done their homework. But lots of times, unions are afraid to strike. We have very few strikes in the United States, which seems fine for employers and most Republicans. But in truth, if you don't have a right to strike, it's very hard to have a progressive, vital labor movement, which I think we need.
Well, and at one time we had. Tell us a little bit about that, about what it was like then, about the important accomplishments and the role they played with the working class in this country. And then let's
When unions were strong, first of all, they bargained it away for everybody, right? They at their peak, they had, let's say, 35% of the workforce organized. But they bargained for everybody because non-union...
Which meant it went across racial lines, for one thing.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was going to get to
that.
Okay,
I'm sorry.
But,
go ahead.
But, of course, the unions, since you raised it, unions played an important role in joining together black and white workers. Now, this, to be clear, this was not without a certain animosity that remained. But the truth is, this relates to the right to strike. When a union strikes, white workers and black workers come to see each other as brothers. And since they've had women in there, when the strike that I described took place by 1,200 paper workers, men, women, black and white, it was brothers and sisters, and they meant it. So union solidarity joins people together. And, of course, when unions got higher wages for people, everybody got it. If unions had a grievance system, the grievance system was open to everybody. So it improved the conditions of blacks and whites and men and women, whoever was in the union. And they also, as I was indicating before, they bargained for non-union people because employers watched what the union got, and in order to avoid a unionization, they often gave that. I mean, I had a friend back in Indiana who was a general counsel for Cummings Engines, which was in Columbus, Indiana, and he told me, he said, yeah, I watch exactly what the UAW gets, and then we match it.
Right.
So the unions, everybody, and workers, by the way, also when unions were strong, workers really felt that they had an important position in the society. Charitable boards, civic organizations would often have union representatives. The working class voice was heard in every major aspect of the society. There were problems. In my books, I don't want to make it sound like everything unions did was good. And unions bear some of the responsibility for their own demise. But much of it came from the courts and, of course, from employers who spend a lot of time figuring out how to defeat unions, precisely because they were unhappy with the constantly increasing wages that the unions were able to obtain, the improved conditions. There's a kind of dignity when you're in a union, which I have witnessed. I've also been a labor arbitrator. If an employee, if a worker in a union establishment feels that they've been unfairly treated, they can file a grievance and have it heard before a neutral arbitrator if they can't be settled before that. And that gives you workers a real sense of dignity. You cannot just be treated arbitrarily. You can't be told, Donald Trump, like, you're fired. Yeah. They could tell you that, but then you can file a grievance and get your job back.
When were unions at their peak, at their point of greatest influence in this country?
Probably in the 1970s, and it began to drop in the 80s. And by the way, it was in the 80s that employers began to permanently replace strikers. For a while, unions were strong enough. I remember in Indiana, as I said, when I was teaching the steel workers, they said, well, how come employers don't permanently replace us? And I said, you're too strong. They don't want to mess with you because they know it leads to, you know, decades of battle, and they don't want that. They'd rather live with you in peace.
Right.
But that was because they were very strong. In the 80s As the organizing began to drop off, employers recognized that they had a chance to really weaken the union movement, and they did. And as I said, the unions bear some of the responsibility. They were self-satisfied, and they thought they had basically arrived, and they thought that the employer opposition was over by about 1980s. And so they really didn't put the focus they should have on continuing to organize. They didn't do the kind of work they should have done to bring together the entire workforce. So they bear some of the responsibility. Union leadership became bureaucratic, separated from the members. But the truth is, I think that could be overcome and was overcome in a lot of different unions that remained strong and militant during this period.
Okay, what role did the courts specifically have then in weakening the unions?
Well, I've mentioned already this absurd McKay doctrine,
right,
whereby even though there's a right to strike, you can lose your job.
Right.
Then there's organizing.
That's a right to quit.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Now, and by the way, the results of that, the book that I wrote called The Betrayal of Local 14 talked about a strike by paper workers in Jay, Maine. And what happened, and I stayed on the story after they came back, the entire community was decimated. People, lifelong friends, friendships were broken up. Families were split. And, you know, by the time, after the replacement of the strikers, there were for sale signs up, stores were closed. So I witnessed the destruction of a community through the replacement of strikers. Now, beyond that, I was talking about organizing, which is what unions had to do. And if you ask any union official, what's your main job? They'll say organizing the unorganized. But the Supreme Court has given employers an enormous advantage in organizing. Employers have the ability to bring all the workers together and give what are known as captive audience speeches, where they give them the case against unions. And by the way, we'll mention, you know, if you join a union, I will bargain hard, you'll have to go out on strike, and I can permanently replace you. So they're basically threatening their jobs, and it was perfectly legal. And they repeat it over and over again. They have meeting after meeting. The union has no right to respond. The union can call meetings at the union hall, but that's a very different thing than being able to bring together everyone. I did my academic claim to fame initially was I did a study with another professor of union organizing elections. And the people, everybody knew what the employer was saying, but people didn't know the union story because they couldn't get, for lots of different reasons, to the union hall. So the employer can call everybody together. They can do it day after day after day after day. And the Supreme Court held that the National Labor Relations Board could not permit a union organizer on the parking lot. Oh, on the parking lot. The labor board said, well, you have to give union organizers some right to talk to the employees, so we will let them be. And the Supreme Court, opinion by Justice Thomas, not surprising, Justice Thomas said, no, the employer has the right to post his property. Anybody who wants to, he can keep off. So that was the right to organize. Then in the right to bargain collectively, which they're supposed to do, the Supreme Court eviscerated that. They removed major decisions from the bargaining, the duty to bargain. Theoretically, employers are supposed to bargain about everything that pertains to wages, hours, and conditions of employment. The Supreme Court then said, well, yeah, but if an employer decides to sell off a piece of the property or to close down a part, it doesn't have to bargain about that. Now, why not? Every conditions of employment, there's nothing more important than whether you have a job
or not. Whether you have a job, right.
That's another major Supreme Court decision about bargaining. And recently, and this one's a little bit trickier, What the Supreme Court has permitted employers to do is to put into their contracts clauses that state, if there's any legal difference between us, you agree to go to arbitration, and you agree to go under terms set by the company, and you agree to go alone. Instead of, so if an employer dismisses a whole group, each one would have to go on their own. Or if the employer wasn't paying the right wages, and it would apply to 100 workers, but they each one would have to get their own lawyer. And this has been devastating to workers throughout the country. The National Labor Relations Board, in an excellent opinion, I add parenthetically, by a former student of mine named Craig Becker, who's now the general counsel of AFL-CIO, said that's illegal under the National Labor Relations Act, and almost every labor law scholar that I know of agreed with the board, but every court, including, not surprisingly, the Fifth Circuit, said, no, we reject the Horton Doctrine, and we say that an employer has a right to put into the contract. And, you know, it's like these little things that says agree or disagree. They hand you your contract, and it says you agree to go to arbitration and to do it on a single basis before arbitrators that we pick, under circumstances that we decide. And Justice Scalia, in one of his last important labor opinions, said that was perfectly all right, and the courts have affirmed that over and over. The New York Times, actually, which is, does not cover labor that often, had a whole series of articles about these arbitration clauses and how terrible they are. Good articles, and that's true. They are terrible, and they're unfair, and they completely miss the whole point of our labor legislation, which is that workers have the right to act collectively. That's at the heart of the National Labor Relations Act, is the idea that workers have the right to engage in concerted activity. The whole point of the Fair Labor Standards Act was to take wages out of individual contracts and set these as the standards. Through these arbitration clauses, employers are able to avoid the collectivization and deal with workers on an individual basis, which is basically brings us back to the 1930s. And I have no doubt that Justice Scalia understood that, because, you know, there's a whole school of thought which began with the University of Chicago, the kind of law and economics idea that the market works better. See, unions to some traditional economists, unions are a distortion of the market because they raise wages and working conditions. And Scalia believed that the market, and others, many others, believed that the market works better, which means the market meaning individual contracts between employers and workers. And this is largely what we've gone back to.
Okay, we need to take a break. This is fascinating. My guest is legal scholar, labor scholar, Julius Gitman, emeritus professor at the University of Texas, and a great guest. So I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. We'll be right back.
I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm
The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die. Says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life, and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on.
Okay. All right. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. My guest is Julius Gettman, and we're talking about the Supreme Court and labor unions, the history of the labor movement, and we were just listening to Paul Robeson, wonderful Paul Robeson, Joe Hill. Joe Hill, just a little side trip, the IWW, the Wobblies, the Industrial Workers of the World, were a pretty amazing little labor story, a labor phenomenon. Did you have any interaction with?
Well, I have over the years, to different Wobblies at different universities where I've been. They've tried to resuscitate the Wobblies. The Wobblies that I've dealt with are not the lumberjacks of another era,
right,
but tend to be graduate students and stuff like right. that. But one thing about Joe Hill that makes him the great martyr of the labor movement is his final words, which were, "Don't mourn for me, organize." And of course, that is the key to labor success. We've been talking about it, is organizing and learning how to organize. And learning how to organize again with the backdrop of the Supreme Court decisions is very difficult. There is really, in many ways, no more difficult job in the world than being a union organizer. It's very tough. It's often a lonely business. You're attacked. You're constantly being under employer pressure in a whole variety of ways. So to successfully organize a union these days, in view of the Supreme Court decisions that we've been talking about, is very, very difficult. And Joe Hill, "Don't mourn for me, organize you." But I've seen, I did a study of organizing, and then years later, when I went, where I taught at Yale, I saw a great organizing drive at work, and it was, and I could take a minute to talk about that. It's something I deal with in my book called Restoring the Power of Unions. The most effective organizing drive I ever saw was the clerical workers at Yale, mainly women employees, significantly underpaid, undervalued. The union organized them, and we discovered, much to a lot of people's surprise, that you had a whole group of women who were natural leaders, who had been doing these minor bureaucratic jobs, the most eloquent speakers I've ever heard, great, great power, and absolutely committed to the union. The union also brought together organized labor throughout the state. They brought together other workers at Yale. They had a committee, which I was actually the head of, called Faculty in Support of Local 34. But the one thing that they did that was so marvelous, because if you know Yale faculty or even imagine, they're used to taking charge of things, right? Yeah. Well, we'll take care of the organizing. No, it's not your organizing drive. It's the clerical workers. And you never heard the leaders, John Wilhelm, who was the guy who led the organizing drive. It was never John who you heard. It was always the women. They were excellent. Andrea Vandenhever, who came from the actually had taken part in the freedom movement in South Africa. They had an extraordinary group, and this was in 1984, and they're they're still powerful and growing in power. They've brought in, for example, some of the graduate students. They've become a political force in the Democratic Party, not only of New Haven, but of Connecticut. They've demonstrated how a combination of good organizing and member-centered leadership by the union could achieve power still, even under today's circumstances. And they went on strike, which was very scary for a lot of the people. But when you have workers who are really committed, they were successful. It was not easy. It was not easy. It was, it was not easy, and also it was not easy to replicate it. It was not easy to replicate it. Mm-hmm. Although an interest,
because it was kind of organic.
Yes, and because you had the best kind of union leadership, which was the kind that didn't want to show itself off, but wanted to show off the members and let them speak. You see this, by the way, today in the battles in the fast food industry. You see the same thing, and they know what they're doing. This is the Service Employees International Union, another very well-led union that has learned how to organize. They let the members speak. You don't hear the organizer's voice. You hear the member's voice. In the 2008 Democratic Convention, I wrote to John Wilhelm, then the president of the Hotel Workers Union. I said, John, at the convention, the best speakers are the union members, and the union leaders not that good. He says, no union leader, including me, has the eloquence of the workers, and that's true. And so that's an interesting point. Unions are fighting. They're learning how to organize. It's difficult. Throughout the history of the labor movement, they have had to organize under conditions which give the employer an enormous advantage. These captive audience speeches, it's very easy to learn how to make a captive audience speech to defeat unions. Mm-hmm. And I could take a class of total beginners in a labor law class, and in 5 minutes, we've sketched out the classic employer arguments. But if you keep doing it day after day after right. day after day, and the union has no chance to respond, it's going to be effective.
There's, of course, a varying kind of labor histories in different states. There are places that are certainly more conducive to labor organizing, Texas not being, I guess, one of the places most conducive, although Texas does have a rich labor history.
It does.
But the right to work laws, how significant are they?
Now, this is where I depart from liberal orthodoxy. Okay. It's not the right to work laws. Right to work is really about whether a union can have what's called a union security agreement after organizing. Okay. So the right to work laws sound like they're very key. What's much more important is what's known as the ability of employers to discharge people, right? It's employment at will is the doctrine, and that means that if the employer is not happy with you, they can fire you. And if they think you're organizing a union, they may well do it, and you're out on your... The right to work laws don't come into effect until a union actually has successfully organized.
Okay.
Then they limit what you can have by way of a union security, which means dues, because unions represent everybody, right? Because unions are supposed to represent everybody in the union, members
and the victories,
or not members.
If unions have victories, those affect everybody, whether they're
exactly.
union members or not.
And and I've seen in the study that I did of the J. Maine, until they decertified the union, they were representing the scabs, whom they hated. I mean, with a passion that's rare, that you rarely see. But if a scab got fired, the union would defend, it would protest. And they felt it was their obligation. I mean, it made them almost sick to do it. But it shows you that they take this obligation to represent the full membership seriously.
May have given the scab second thoughts, too.
Some of them might have had
some kind of effect in terms of...
I interviewed them, and they were... A lot of them had guilt feelings, but they all were justifying themselves, and they all were in tough economic circumstances. Some had family illnesses and stuff. Interviewing the scabs was interesting for this reason. They had jobs, and the former strikers didn't. But the former strikers were incredibly proud of them, of the fight they put on. And the scabs were filled with guilt of what they'd done. 10 years later, I was at the University of Maine, and we were talking about it. And one of the women students in the class got up, and she said she was the daughter of a former striker, and she was 10 years, she was still proud of her father and glad that he'd taken part. So it's an interesting thing. And as I said, it brought black and white, male and female together. After that strike, this had been a pretty conservative group in central Maine. Jesse Jackson came, gave a talk during the strike, excellent talk, one of his best. And they ended up, the president of that local union ended up being in charge of labor for Jackson. It's really interesting. One of the women I interviewed said, you know, I had the normal prejudices. I'd never thought I'd want to give to Jesse Jackson. But after he came out and spoke, I donated money to his campaign.
Yeah. He was pretty impressive.
If I have it on tape, if you listen to it, it was really a great speech, and he told them basically how he stood with the strikers, and even he in a place in Wisconsin where the strikers were white and the scabs were mainly black, and he said didn't matter, he was going to side with the strikers.
Right. Tell me, when we come back, we're going to take a break in about another 4 minutes or something. And when we come back from that, I want to talk about politics. I want to talk about the white working class. I want Trump's appeal, the failures of the Democrats, a lot of that. First, tell me what you think, how you assess the strength of the labor movement today. That's part one. And then part two is going to be what can happen if there are changes on the Supreme Court.
Oh, that's an interesting question. But the labor, I think there's a lot of undercover support for unionism around the country that needs to be kind of politically organized. I've noticed the Democrats rarely mention unions and collective bargaining, but I notice every time they do, they get a tremendous response. Mm-hmm. There's more eagerness to see what we need, I believe, is a Democratic, vigorous labor movement. I think that would be a great addition to this country. And I think there's the feeling out there. And so I think there's an opportunity. The law is a major barrier. If we could get rid of, for example, the McKay Doctrine that permits the replacement of striking workers and the right to strike could come back to strength, I think that would make a major difference. I think if we change the rules about organizing, and this stupid rule that declares that employers have the right to require employees to really forego their rights to, let's say, go to a federal agency and enforce them instead to go to arbitration, if we can get rid of that, I think the circumstances are there. I also think that the current leadership of organized labor is better and less bureaucratic than it was, say, 10 or 15 years ago. So I think there's good leadership in the labor movement. I think there's a lot of undercurrent interest. Of course, there's also a lot of fear. If you go to any group, and it's not limited to Texas, almost anywhere, and tell a group of workers, and say, you know, have you guys thought about unionizing? They immediately begin to whisper. And they say, no, we hit with it, you know. Yeah. And they talk, they're afraid. And the fear is there before they really start to organize.
Right.
So if you could make sure, if workers could feel secure in the right to organize, I think there'd be tremendous organizing. You know, the polls show that a majority of workers in the United States would like to be in a union. And yet what we have in the private sector is like 5%, 8%. And, you know, it's a combination of fear and the law.
What about the importance of the, and we have just a minute, so, of like the Starbucks workers, the Walmart, the kind of, you know, I know you talked about service workers union, but these kind of almost sort of outside the box kind of organizing efforts that have happened and have been pretty successful.
Well, I think, yes, I think what you said, they have been successful. They have been presenting the grievances. There have been new forms of organizing going on. The National Labor Relations Board, we have one of the strongest labor boards. One of the things that the Obama administration has done right is appointed good people to the National Labor Relations Board. So we have a strong labor board that is trying to make it possible for fast food workers to organize, and I think what it has already improved the lives of fast food workers, and I think it presents a model to workers, other workers around the country, and I think unless you think workers are really stupid, then they'll catch on. By the way, in my study of union organizing, I talked, you know, to hundreds and hundreds of workers. And the one thing you come away with is a realization of the intelligence and integrity of the American worker. These are not, you know, stupid people. Some of them are uneducated, and they really care about their jobs. But there's a basic decency and understanding on the part of workers. And if the unions, I think if the unions had a chance under the law, that could be activated.
Okay, labor law scholar Jack Gettman is the author of The Supreme Court on Unions, Why Labor Law is Failing American Workers. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. We'll be right back.
Now, you want higher wages. Let me tell you what to do. Got to talk to the workers in the shop with you. You got to build you a union, got to make it strong, but if you all stick together, boys, won't be long. You got shorter hours, better working conditions, vacations with pay, take your kids to the seashore. Of course, it ain't quite that simple, so I better explain just why you got to ride on the union train. Because if you wait for the boss to raise your pay, we'll all be waiting till Judgment Day. We'll all be buried, gone to heaven. St. Peter will be the straw boss then, boys. Now you know you're underpaid, but the boss says you ain't. He speeds up the work till you're about to faint. You may be down and out, but you ain't beaten. Pass out a leaflet, call a meeting, talk it over. Speak your mind. Decide to do something about it. Cause the boss may persuade some poor damn fool to go to your meeting and act like a stool. But you can always tell a stool, though, that's a fact. He's got a yellow streak running down his back. He doesn't have to stool, you know.
Okay. Pete Seeger and Paul Robeson, that's... What could be better for our music breaks here?
Well, we need them brought up to date. The unfortunate fact is neither is among the living anymore.
Yeah, I know. Julius Gettman is our guest, and we're talking about... Well, right now we're going to talk about the Supreme Court. We're talking about labor law and the state of the labor unions and the effect that the court system and specifically the Supreme Court has had on them. So sort of to get back to the second part of my earlier question, if we end up, if say Hillary Clinton wins, and if we have a Democratic majority in the Senate, whatever, and some more two more progressive Supreme Court nominees are added to the Supreme Court, what difference will that make?
Well, I think...
What can they do, and how will that affect?
I think the easiest one to overturn would be the rule about arbitration and the ability of employers to put these arbitration clauses in the agreements, because that was a 5-4 decision, mm-hmm. and it was a very strong and bitter dissent, and Justice Scalia wrote the lead opinion in that case. And so I think there'd be a very good chance that the Concepcion case, which is the one that declared this doctrine, would be overturned. And that would make a significant difference. The one that labor scholars are arguing and wondering about, certainly including myself, is whether we could overturn the McKay doctrine about the replacement, the ability of employers to replace strikers. And I'm not sure. I've suggested that even a liberal court might not be willing to do that because that doctrine has been out there so long. Some people that I admire think I may well be wrong about this. There was an interesting article. There's a website working in these times, and a very good article by a guy named Saul Richman. He thinks that doctrine might be overturned. Mm-hmm. I'm a little skeptical, so I don't know. I'd like to find out. It would be nice to have a more liberal Supreme Court. It would be nice to have one that recognized the importance of the policy. You notice from 1935 till now, it has been the official policy of the United States, stated in the National Labor Relations Act, to encourage the practice and process of collective bargaining. If we had a court that would actually believe that and try to enforce that policy, I think that you could have significant differences. The most important change would be to get rid of the McKay doctrine, whether we will or not, hard to say. They're certainly looking, the labor board, of ways of making the organizing process more equal. The truth of it is the organizing process is supposed to reflect the views of the workers, but it doesn't. Because of the fact that the employers have access, it would be as if one candidate in a political election, you know, had constant access to the news media, and the others would have to use a loudspeaker.
Okay.
So that's a possibility of change. It's hard to tell, but I think the arbitration clause would be changed. I think there's a good chance that the right to collective bargaining would be increased. And there's a possibility that the court would finally address the McKay doctrine. The craziest thing about that doctrine is it's totally inconsistent with basic labor law doctrine. Under basic labor law doctrine, workers have a right to engage in collective bargaining or concerted activities without being penalized at the job. The Supreme Court has announced that over and over again, and yet they permit this doctrine where exactly the opposite of what they say is the law. As a matter of fact, the case itself actually held the opposite of what the Supreme Court stated. So it's a crazy business in the law. It's what's known as a dictum by the court. It wasn't crucial to the decision. It has ruled labor law for many, many decades. It's inconsistent with the law, inconsistent with the statute, and even inconsistent with the court's holding in the case. So I look at that and I say, well, they've had so many chances. It's so obvious they haven't changed it. I worry about whether they're willing to look at it and say, we've been wrong for all these decades. That's one of the things that's very difficult for the court to do.
Okay. All right. Donald Trump. Donald Trump and his appeal to the one area, even with his recent collapse, the one constituency he's held is, I think, white men without college degrees. His appeal to the white working class is it more than ethno-nationalism?
Oh, I think so.
Is it, and what is the role of the Democratic Party and its failure to address the white working class in recent years?
Well, to me, it's very much tied in with policies towards unions. When unions were strong, the working class was much more solidified and much more liberal. And the unions played a role in thwarting the efforts of populist demagogues. The best example, I was teaching at Indiana University in the 1960s when George Wallace came along talking about pointy-headed liberals and had some real appeal. The steel workers, the auto workers in Indiana, they checked out on his record of what he had done in Alabama. They brought in workers from Alabama. He went from like 40% in his previous in the previous primary to 8% in Indiana, and he was done as a. And it was the unions that did it. The unions played a role, and as I've said, the anger that workers feel today is, to me, quite understandable. They have been ignored. They don't know where to turn to, and I believe that the Democratic Party, which I have regularly supported, has some of the blame. They haven't really been interested in the rights of the working class, and they do feel, and it's sort of inevitable, well, there's affirmative action for everybody, there are all these other policies, when do we get it? And of course, the unions were, in effect, and the policies of the law favoring unions were policies favoring workers. And to the extent that we would return to those policies, you bring workers together. If you're bargaining and everybody's going to get the same raise, it's very hard to see the worker of a different ethnicity as the enemy, because you want them on the same. And when you walk a picket line, it really does create a sense of solidarity that's rare. The hotel workers at the Frontier Hotel in Las Vegas, who conducted one of the great strikes of recent history, every ethnicity involved, and the sense of solidarity among the workers in Las Vegas who are members of the culinary is just striking. Go into a casino on the strip, talk, which I do, both because I like to gamble and because I like to find out. You know, if you talk to workers about their unions, you'll often
get mixed. So it's a twofer for you.
It's a twofer. What do you think of the culinary? I always say, the thumbs up, you bet. I mean, they really mean it, you know? And it's because, it really does create a sense of solidarity. It's important that the union leaders not take credit for everything. We did it. So that the workers feel, yes, we've done it. We've created that. That's what the clerical workers felt at Yale. It's our union. The unions always say that. You know, you are the union. But you've got to really make that true. Now, with regard to, so I think that the ignoring of unions, they have not been a part of the liberal agenda to an extent they should be. And I think, although it's somewhat indirect, I think white workers kind of feel that. And I think if we had a stronger labor movement, the labor movement itself would help to thwart Trump's efforts. Plus, the workers would feel more of a sense of solidarity across these class lines. You know, across these lines, you see it in the army. When you're in the service, as I was during the period of the Korean War, you see that same thing. Different ethnicities have to work together in the service. They have to work together in a union. So unions create the single most important thing for workers: solidarity. And that's why solidarity is the key to labor unions, and it has been noted, the one group in our society, or the Catholic Church, they sort of recognize that. And there's a whole, the social teachings of the church were all about solidarity.
Well, it's, you know, one problem with somebody like Trump, and it was true with Wallace, I guess, too, although Wallace was more directly racial in his, but is that Trump is able to sort of tap into the discontent, but he doesn't appeal to the better angels.
Wallace, sure. And there've been loads of people. It's not like we don't have a history in the United States of populist demagogues, right?
Oh yeah.
And we do. And often when you have economic downturns, people will listen to them. Having a strong labor movement is a powerful force against them. But this is one of those battles that is constantly having to be refought. It's not as though, okay, we'll have a strong labor movement, demagoguery will go away. It never does.
No, it doesn't. It's part and parcel. One thing that we do see, though, is there's this incredible shift in demographics in this country. There's a shift in demographics within the Democratic Party, for instance, that Hillary does not, for instance, reflect the grassroots, the new kind of progressive element in the party. And youth, you know, young people in this country are so different. And it's just striking. I mean, look at the polling when Bernie Sanders was running and the incredible difference. And the fact that suddenly in polling, socialism actually rated ahead of capitalism.
Well,
in the polls,
yeah, and of course.
But anyway, in any event, it's kind of changing the way people think. It's changing the constructs a little bit.
Yeah, and Bernie Sanders' campaign, which actually amazed me in its success, but it demonstrated that the anger which is out there can be turned in different directions, right?
Right.
And he was excellent at that. And because he really gave the impression, and I think because it's accurate, that he really cared, he wasn't, not only wasn't he for sale, he wasn't going to shift his positions in accordance with the whims of the time. Hillary is not as successful, needless to say, as that. We need, I think the, although she's a friend, so I'm, but I think Elizabeth Warren is really the leader, political leader of liberalism right now, or Liz and Bernie together are quite a pair, and demonstrate that you can channel feelings of discontent into progressive movement. It doesn't have to be connected to something as crazy as the Trump movement.
Yeah, and the authenticity of Sanders and his movement, because Sanders, that's who he's been for his whole political life.
Right.
But the fact that there are people then who, in especially among white working people, who see Trump as being somehow authentic.
But yeah, and of course that's true. And it, you know what? He is authentic in the sense that he's different.
2 minutes.
He's different than the stereotype of politician. But it is interesting for purposes of this discussion that when you polled Trump supporters, who was their number two? It was Bernie. And a lot of Bernie people have trouble accepting Hillary. Which is all understandable. It was partly that this anger, which joins them together. And that's a remarkable statistic. And obviously Trump knew that because he's gone very easy on Bernie and he's talked about how Bernie was right, it is rigged and all that. And that was, I think, because the polls indicated that there was a surprising interchange between their supporters.
Yeah.
So
Shocking, as far as I'm concerned, but yes.
One of the things I think that's hardest for intellectuals like me to recognize about workers and most of the population is that they don't decide on the basis of a consistent political philosophy. A lot of the decision is visceral. This is a person I trust, as opposed to this is a person whose ideas I agree with, right?
Right. Right, trust. Okay, we have about a minute. Looking forward, what do you expect to happen?
I wish I could give a totally optimistic forecast. I think the labor movement in this country will continue to struggle, but I do believe that we may be entering a period where a lot of the anger by workers and gets channeled properly into the labor movement. I think we have the potential for it.
Yeah.
And I've seen it happen. And just a quick word, what you need really is an alliance between workers and intellectuals, and we don't have that, and I blame the intellectuals for that more than anybody else.
As long as we can keep jobs in this country and human beings doing the jobs. So, I mean, those are factors.
Well,
we've got to go. We'll do this again.
Yeah.
We'll take up right here when we get started. So
yeah,
my guest has been Julius Gettman. We've been talking about labor law and the Supreme Court and the future of the labor union. I want to tell you, coming up, Jim Hightower is going to be with us again on September 2nd. So look forward to that. Tracy, thank you. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is RAG Radio.